Hi all. From the team here at the HPS podcast, we welcome you to another episode. I'm your host, Indigo Keel, and today we welcome Gerhard Weisenfeld to the podcast. He discusses with us the advantages of studying the unknown scientist. What can we learn when we turn away from the big names in science? What do we gain from studying those who haven't gained notoriety? And who is leading the charge on studying these unknown scientists? Hi, Gerhard.
Hello.
Welcome to the HPS podcast. So I'll start by asking, as we always do, how did you come into HPS?
Okay, after a long stint between high school and university, I finally decided to do a physics degree. That was back in Germany. And by pure coincidence, I started at the one university where a physics degree, which was a 6 year degree leading straight to a master at that point, didn't require a mandatory minor in either chemistry or computer science, but allowed for a various, much broader range of possible minors, which included philosophy. So I did philosophy as a minor for 2 years, which went well, but was rather overcrowded, quite a lot of students in there. After 2 years, when there was this mid-study exams and I passed them, I had the chance to change. So I looked around what I'm going to do next and realized there's also history of science as a minor. I changed over to there and found that a very nice department, not as overcrowded as philosophy was, but also answering questions in ways that I found much easier to comprehend. So my, say, key moment probably was a talk by the historian Herbert Mertens on modern mathematics. And since I had just done a philosophy seminar on the philosophy of modern mathematics, which was mind-bogglingly hard for all of us, and then hearing a historical take on that and said, oh, historical epistemology explains things so much more straightforward than abstract reasoning. Maybe that's the thing the way I want to go to.
As always, not the most straightforward path into a discipline, but having a background in science is always a benefit. So what do you see as the value of HPS, both for those who study it and for a broader audience?
Okay, for those who study it, or let's just say in general for people at university, I think HPS is an important corrective to the way that university is typically run in disciplinary structures, which mandates certain types of thinking, certain types of communications within disciplines. It is quite important for a university that actually wants to keep at least some connection to what a university was supposed to be, to have a discipline that is actually not a discipline as such, but rather finds itself as something that you could consider a field where people with different interests come in and do different things, and that gives some kinds of cohesions. I mean, HPS is not the only one in there. Geography is another one that comes to mind where I always see that people looking from outside on those kind of fields are kind of, what are you actually doing? You're so different than what we do. But inside it, most of the time, feels quite nice. I mean, towards the outside world or the world outside the ivory tower, of course, it's a very different affair in the sense of talking to people about science in a different way that tries to avoid this kind of either glorifying science as the best thing ever that happened in the history of humanity, but also avoiding this kind of blind negation of science or this kind of demonization of science as something evil that is not to be trusted at all. So to have a voice that gives a bit of a nuanced account and says, okay, here are the boundaries of legitimate reasoning and everything that falls other sides is something that we discard for what we consider to be good reasons.
Absolutely. Do you have a topic that you'd like to share with us today that you believe would be of interest to a broader audience?
I take a cue line from Fallon's podcast, where she talked about biography in general. And one of the topics that has always been dear to my heart is looking at people that were involved in science that were by no means in any way major figures, major achievers. Many of them you can actually describe as complete failures, but people who just worked in science without getting any serious kind of reward, or the rewards they were getting were quite different than what you would expect from, say, a Charles Darwin or an Isaac Newton to get.
And why do you believe that this topic is important to look at?
Let's look at different parts of, say, scientific development. If we look at, say, what is kind of classically known as modern science, this kind of framework of scientific disciplines that feed through university degrees that has basically come in the early 19th century. If you look there at those kind of careers of unknown people, you learn actually much more about the structures of those kind of systems, the kind of reward system or the career patterns, if you look at people who had to struggle to get through. So at one point I did research on a German scientist, if you want to call him, Karl Konstantin Haberle, completely unknown, who basically tried to make a career in science or in education and tried virtually everything that he could, looking first, setting up, I'll just set a private school for myself, that failed after 2 years, and then to try to set up the discipline of meteorology, because he realized meteorology would really be useful, but we don't have a discipline of meteorology, and realized, what do I need for this? And actually, it was quite successful. He had a publisher, an academic publisher as a backer, set up a scientific journal, set up a scientific society, even something like a scientific community. Almost looked like somebody who's read a Wikipedia page, hey, which makes a scientific discipline. Oh, yes, I need all of this. How can I get that done? That was, of course, early 19th century. No way to do that. And that failed and then kept on struggling, tried to build a patronage network that was rather old-fashioned, but ultimately got him into the professorship of botany at the University of Pest, modern-day Budapest, where he then had a very ordinary scientific career, publishing a bit about the flora of Hungary and those kind of things. But just following this kind of career pattern shows you a lot how to get into that. Or something that is not at all my own research, but the work of the Australian historian, Greg Denning, who wrote a biography of William Gooch. If you've never heard about William Gooch, you would be well excused, because everybody who's heard about this has heard about him because of Greg Denning. Gooch was an English astronomer in the late 18th century, went on the first voyage with the British Navy on an expedition on the Pacific, and then was murdered by the native population at the age of 23. So he never really achieved much in his life, but nonetheless, following the pathway from him being basically a village kid through various kind of scholarships, kind of perceiving the study at Cambridge University and then getting into astronomy, really is one of the sciences at that point that was open for people from the lower class, because simply the colonial empire had such a big need for astronomers, and then try to make his life as a scientist on a ship of the Navy is something that's quite interesting to see. Okay, and this is how science worked at that point, where you learn much more than if you study the career of successful astronomers, where you then basically just goes, oh, he's discovered that and that and that kind of thing.
Well, there's always just as much to learn from the ordinary as there is from the extraordinary, because the ordinary shows how it worked the majority of the time. Do you have any other case studies that you believe would be of interest?
It's really not much more than a talk I've heard a long time ago by a Swedish PhD student, now an established academic, Thomas Kaiserfeld, who gave a talk about Ragnar Holm. And he started the talk with the words that stuck in the minds of everyone who's heard that, and said, Ragnar Holm is not just unknown because he's Swedish, he's also unknown in Sweden. It's a very similar case. It is a Swedish physics student who had done great things, went over to Germany in the early 20th century at the University of Göttingen, the most prestigious university for physics at that time, to do a PhD, and failed his PhD. His academic career was over, but then went through industry research and actually did quite a lot of things, to the point that IEEE, as the major body for engineering, still today has what they call a Ragnar Holm Prize for electric contact theory, which he did all in industry research because he couldn't get into academia on account of his early failure. Kaiserfeld unfortunately abandoned that as a PhD topic, which tells us something of the problem that we have working on unknown people. Maybe something of a career suicide for modern-day historians of science, and saying, we want to talk about the major people, but one of the problems we get into that, we have what is effectively known as the Newton industry or the Darwin industry, which is big enough to be more or less self-sufficient and ignore everything that happens outside that kind of industry. I don't want to say that with too big of a grudge against those people who are in those kind of industries. Yes, we clearly need people working on Newton, Darwin, or Galileo. But we also need a corrective there. We also need to understand that science actually does not work by great men and great women, but rather a multitude of people that work with different ways, different pathways, who ultimately also make quite a lot of important decisions about who gets accepted. A case study that I take here from my PhD supervisor is Anton Lamper, another very unknown physicist, an Austrian physicist, who did quite interesting work. None of that actually inside physics. He did quite a lot of things in popular education about science in Vienna, but beforehand was very instrumental in getting Albert Einstein his first professorship. So it doesn't mean that without Anton Lamper, Albert Einstein would have never become famous, but nonetheless, you can see, okay, here's somebody who actually is quite interesting, and of course, also the way that Lamper got Einstein the professorship is basically by annoying the person that the University of Prague, where he was at that point, wanted to appoint somebody else. And Lamper wrote to that person, said, actually, we want Einstein. And that other person was so annoying that they decided not to take up that professorship, and Einstein got in instead.
It pays to be annoying sometimes. What can we learn from studying the unknown scientist that we miss out on if we only focus on the big names like Einstein and Newton and Galileo?
There are a few things we can learn. I mean, we, of course, learn a lot more of the what I would call the fun stuff, a lot more about things when saying, this was really possible, this was happening, this was unclear. What are people doing in at that kind of work if they do not science as a vocation, but rather science is something that was somewhere on their mind, which they tried. They might work it, they might not work it. So we learn much more about the options that people had. Because, yes, if you get famous early on, you probably get pushed into this. Other people might just do it as a bit of pastime and they take it a bit more serious on this. But also we find much more about the discussions. Say, if we go back to Lamper and the case with Einstein, what ordinary physicists thought about Einstein at that point. Because one of the questions is this kind of, yes, in retrospect, heroes are always heralded as this kind of big names, but what were actually the normal physics professor of the day was thinking of that? People who didn't really care much for the theory of electrons and therefore were not really that interested in the theory of special relativity, but rather were doing experimental work. Or in the case that goes back to my research on 17th century Holland, what people thought of Isaac Newton in the 1680s and 1690s. And it's by no means that people were thinking, oh, Newton is so great. But the first mention of Newton at Leiden University was actually in a student disputation. And I should also mention for general audience, Leiden University in the 1710s became instrumental in disseminating Newton's views around Europe. But in the 1690s, the first version was, yes, oh, Newton has written a work in which he has actually proved Kepler's laws. And that is Newton's achievement by 1690s in Holland. We think, okay, that is quite different from here's the new herald of modern science or modern physics coming in. So we find much more about what is going on, not on the margins, but on this kind of ordinary life world of physicists that are not dealing with, hey, here is this kind of new great theory coming in. In similar ways, we can go for the reception of, say, Antoine Lavoisier's chemistry and look at, yeah, so what were actually ordinary people going for with that? And here's what we also find, yes, most of the time they were just ignoring it.
And what led you into doing this kind of work as opposed to focusing on those big names?
Okay, two things. One is actually my PhD supervisor. This is a bit of academic legacy because he had a severe falling out with his PhD supervisor. His PhD supervisor thought that it was worthless not to do research on anybody who didn't get a Nobel Prize in the 20th century or something equivalent for earlier centuries. So the case of Anton Lamper is the biography that my PhD supervisor, Andreas Kleinert, has then written at one point. So he led me very early on this kind of, yeah, studying minor figures has its use. But also, what I find, it's much more fascinating because you discover so much more about those kind of people because nobody has ever looked closely. And suddenly you think, what is going on there? There is a really odd thing that I noticed when I was doing research on one of my PhD at Leiden University, in the university archives. There was this manuscript by a guy called Jan Kaisers van Breda, who claimed to be in Batavia, so modern-day Jakarta, and wrote this book on natural philosophy that he wanted Leiden University to publish. And that was there in two copies, one that was supposed to be given to William of Orange as the Supreme Curator of the University. And the University obviously didn't quite know what to do with this. Then I started looking, what is this on about? And found this kind of long correspondence between Caesar and the University, which was rather hard because the correspondence between the island of Java and Holland in the 17th century, as you can imagine, is not an easy way. And many of the letters got astray for various reasons or claimed to have gotten astray. So there was quite a lot of things going on. And then later on, he actually published something on alchemy, which had nothing to do with that kind of particular book. It's just a fascinating story in itself. What you can also see, and this is one of the serious problems with staying on this kind of focus line. Material in archives is always one of a tricky issues. Academic archives are even worse, so because academics knew about their own importance, or they thought very highly of their own importance, so they curated the kind of archives very specifically. So you need to make sure that you read the archive against the grain. So therefore, you look at these kind of things that are somewhere in the margin that were almost forgotten to be left out of the archive, that some have made in by mistake, and trying to find out that is, again, an important corrective to a kind of standardized view of history of science.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Gerhard.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Thank you for listening to the HPS podcast, where we discuss all things history, philosophy, and social studies of science. We want to thank the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne for their support. To learn more, check out our website at hpsunimelb.org. There, you can also find links to our blog, Twitter, Facebook, Insta, as well as show notes for today's topic. I'm Indigo Keel, and my co-producer is Samara Greenwood. We look forward to having you back again next time.